By contrast, checks and balances were virtually non-existent. There had been no time to put them in place, and all the powerful sectional interests were opposed to them. With considerable courage, at the start of his second term, President Obasanjo began to introduce the missing checks and balances. One of the first restraints, astonishing only in that it had previously been absent, was to require that public investment projects be put out for competitive bidding. When this requirement was first introduced, it was made slightly retroactive. Some projects that had previously been approved were recalled. The process of competitive bidding reduced the cost of these recalled projects by an average of 40%. These two Nigerian examples, the massive increase in the cost of a dam generated by the transition to unrestrained electoral competition, and the massive reduction in costs generated by basic restraints, illustrate the sheer scale of the dangers facing the resource-rich democracies. So is it back to autocracy? The rather depressing evidence gathered above might appear to suggest that the resource-rich societies should stick with autocracy. That would be a pretty distasteful result. After all, democracy is desirable for powerful reasons, irrespective of its effect on the economy. However, for nearly all the societies of the bottom billion, autocracy would also be wrong even in economic terms. There is a powerful reason why autocracy does not work well in most societies of the bottom billion. Ethnic diversity. I have already discussed ethnic diversity in the context of the conflict trap. There I was able to be quite upbeat. There is little link between ethnic diversity and an elevated risk of conflict, but its wider effects on the economic growth process are less benign. Autocracy seems to work well for the economy only in societies that are not ethnically diverse. The astonishing success of China glows like a beacon to some of the autocrats of bottom billion societies, but it is a radically misleading comparison. China is an example of a homogeneous autocracy, whereas many bottom billion societies are characterized by ethnically diverse autocracies. Globally, autocracy in ethnically diverse societies reduces growth, and the most likely reason is that diversity tends to narrow the support base of the autocrat. Typically, in ethnically diverse societies, autocrats depend upon the support of their own ethnic group. Think of Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni Muslim and whose Ba'ath Party was composed mainly of Sunnis, to the detriment of Iraq's Shiites and Kurds. The more diverse the society, the smaller the autocrat's group is likely to be. This, in turn, changes the incentives for the autocrat. The narrower the base of social support, the stronger the incentive for economic policy to sacrifice growth in order to redistribute income to the autocrat's group. Hence, in the context of ethnic diversity such as in Nigeria, and indeed Iraq, autocracy has failed to generate conditions conducive to growth, and its return would hold no promise of improvement. The uncomfortable implication is that electoral competition is not enough to overcome the blockage to growth generated by autocracy. It merely shifts the form of the blockage to a more broadly diffused wastage of resources through patronage. In the context of ethnic diversity and resource rents, electoral competition is necessary, but not sufficient. The resource-rich, ethnically diverse societies need a democracy that is distinctive in having a strong emphasis on political restraints relative to electoral competition. This cocktail is rare, but it does exist. An example is Botswana, a country rich in diamonds. Although Botswana has been a democracy continuously since its independence, none of its elections has actually changed the government. Electoral competition could not reasonably be described as intense. It has, however, managed to preserve adherence to due process. A notable aspect of this has been that all public investment projects have been required to meet a minimum rate of return. The clear evidence that this has been enforced is that a very large amount of surplus funds has been accumulated in foreign assets. Democracy in Botswana thus stands in contrast to past democracy in Nigeria. The two have had a radically different balance between electoral competition and checks and balances. They have also had radically different growth outcomes. Botswana has transformed itself into a middle-income country, decisively escaping the bottom billion. Indeed, for a long period, it achieved the world's fastest growth rate. Why is natural resource abundance a trap? Why do I describe natural resource abundance in the societies of the bottom billion as a trap? Oil has been fine for Norway, so why not for Chad? I do not want to underplay the conventional economic explanations, Dutch disease and volatility in commodity prices. They inhibit growth even if a country's politics are reasonable. Between them, they come close to closing off a country's chances of diversifying into manufactured and service exports, and these are pretty big opportunities to close off. And I think that the political science explanation is also important. Resource rents are likely to induce autocracy. In the ethnically diverse societies at the bottom billion, such autocracies are likely to be highly detrimental for economic development, as was Saddam Hussein's rule in Iraq. But what I've been concerned to show is that even replacing autocracy with democracy, not an easy thing to do, since autocrats generally cling tenaciously to power, is unlikely to be enough. The sort of democracy that the resource-rich societies of the bottom billion are likely to get is itself dysfunctional for economic development. In the transition to democracy, there are strong incentives for different groups to compete for election, but there are no corresponding incentives for them to build restraints. Restraints are a public good that it is in nobody's particular interest to supply. So if resource riches are so bad for restraints, how come Norway has them? Well, it got them before it got its oil. Not only is growth good in itself, but it feeds back upon the rules of the political game. Political restraints are promoted by a higher level of per capita income. Economic development gradually induces healthy institutional change. So political institutions, in part, reflect past growth as well as influence future growth. Norway has nothing special by way of restraints. It just has the sort of rules that are normal for its level of development. It is this that creates the possibility of a political development trap. A low-income, resource-rich society that either is an ethnically diverse autocracy or acquires the instant lopsided democracy of electoral competition without checks and balances is likely to misuse its opportunities in ways that make it fail to grow. This, in turn, closes off the path that most societies have taken to building a balanced form of democracy, namely through economic development. The resource trap may well extend beyond the bottom billion. Many of the middle-income, resource-rich societies, notably Russia, Venezuela, and countries in the Middle East, could well be caught in it. At least for their citizens, life is not as miserable as in the bottom billion, because they are stagnant at middle-income levels rather than being stagnant at the bottom. So I want to suggest not that the resource trap is unique to the bottom billion, just that it is important to them. Why it matters for G8 policy. Citizens of the G8 are less likely to think, so what, about the natural resource trap than about the conflict trap. Very obviously, failures in resource-rich countries impinge on the rest of us. Iraq is certainly an example of that. They also represent a massive waste of the money that we are paying these countries to buy their resources. As I will discuss in Chapter 7, the payments are far larger than aid, and they are far less effective in generating economic development. Even if you do not care about your money being wasted as long as you can buy the natural resources, you need to worry about the resource curse. It is a commonplace that the rich world wants to shift its dependence on oil away from the Middle East. That is where Africa and Central Asia come in. Yet it is also a commonplace that one reason why the Middle East is in such difficulties is that it has had such large oil revenues. Shifting our source of supply simply will not work as a security measure if the resource curse shifts with it. Becoming reliant upon the bottom billion for natural resources sounds to me like Middle East too. Fortunately, precisely because we are intimately involved in the resource trap as its paymasters, we have instruments ready at hand to break it. We just have not got around to using them. I am going to argue in Chapter 9 that it is not mere chance that we have not tried to fix the problem. The resource trap has two ends, and we are stuck at one of them. Each rich, resource-hungry country is locked into a prisoner's dilemma of inaction. But first, I will turn to another trap. Chapter 4. Landlocked with bad neighbors. One day, while I was director of the research department of the World Bank, A young Ghanaian came to see me. He was working in the Central African Republic as the economic advisor to the Prime Minister. That alone tells you something about the Central African Republic. The Prime Minister could not find a national to be his economic advisor. The country had produced scarcely any educated people, and years of bad governance had induced these few to flee. Even the Prime Minister was a returned exile. Anyway, this serious-minded young man had read my work and wanted advice on what the country could possibly do to get out of stagnation. Eventually, in 2002, I paid a visit to the country, where at the airport I was met by a crew from the national television station as if I were a celebrity. That also tells you something, that nobody visits the Central African Republic. When I settled into discussions with the government, I asked them a question that I always ask when advising a government, because it forces people to get concrete and also serves as a measure of ambition. Which country did they wish to be like in 20 years' time? The group of government ministers discussed it among themselves for a while, then turned back to me with the answer. Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso? In fact, it was not a foolish answer by any means. The two countries share some important characteristics, and Burkina Faso has been doing about as well as possible given those conditions. But it remains dirt poor. That the realistic horizon of ambition for the Central African Republic in 20 years should be to get to where Burkina Faso now is speaks of despair. This chapter is going to be about one aspect of geography that matters for development and which condemns the Central African Republic and Burkina Faso to the slow lane. Among economists, there has been a realization over the past decade that geography matters. There have been two pioneering lines of analysis in researching the importance of geography, completely different and complementary. One looks at geographic differences between places, and the scholar who pioneered this was Jeff Sachs. The other line of analysis, less intuitively, poses the question of what happens if countries all start out at the same level, but some countries get in first on various opportunities. The scholars who led this work were Paul Krugman and Tony Venables. Both these sets of ideas matter a lot for understanding the problems of the bottom billion. One is going to be the subject of this chapter, and the other features in part three. Sachs's work suggested that being landlocked clipped around half a percentage point off the growth rate. The standard slick response to Jeff's concerns was to point to Switzerland, Austria, or Luxembourg, or in Africa to Botswana, for a long time the fastest growing country in the world. It is true that being landlocked does not necessarily condemn a country either to poverty or to slow growth, but 38% of the people living in bottom billion societies are in countries that are landlocked, and as you will see, it is overwhelmingly an African problem. Because Africa's problems are usually ascribed to its being Africa, and the rest of the world hasn't got the problem of being landlocked, the difficulties that it generates have been underplayed. Neighbors matter. I was lucky while directing the World Bank's research department to recruit Tony Venables to head its research division on trade, and I encouraged him to look further into the problems of being landlocked. Tony managed to find data on the cost of transporting a container from ports in the United States and Europe to capital cities around the world. Sure enough, cities that were the capitals of landlocked countries incurred much higher transport costs. However, the big surprise was that the costs varied enormously in ways that did not seem to depend upon distance. Tony eventually tracked this down. The transport costs for a landlocked country depended upon how much its coastal neighbor had spent on transport infrastructure. One way of thinking about this was that landlocked countries were hostages to their neighbors. Why is Uganda poor when Switzerland is rich? It is indeed partly that Switzerland's access to the sea depends upon German and Italian infrastructure, whereas Uganda's access to the sea depends upon Kenyan infrastructure. Which do you imagine is better? If you are landlocked with poor transport links to the coast that are beyond your control, it is very difficult to integrate into global markets for any product that requires a lot of transport, so forget manufacturing, which to date has been the most reliable driver of rapid development. But I wondered whether neighbors were also important in another way. Maybe landlocked countries depended upon their neighbors not just as transport corridors to overseas markets, but also directly as markets. Maybe Germany and Italy were not in the way of Switzerland's market. they were Switzerland's market. Switzerland was not cut off from its market, it was surrounded by it. Well, why not Uganda? All landlocked countries are by definition surrounded by neighbors. Unfortunately, some neighbors are better as markets than others. Switzerland has Germany, Italy, France, and Austria. Uganda has Kenya, which has been stagnant for nearly three decades. Sudan, which has been embroiled in a civil war. Rwanda, which had a genocide. Somalia, which completely collapsed. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, the history of which was sufficiently catastrophic for it to change its name from Zaire. And finally, Tanzania, which invaded it. You could say that at least in recent decades, Switzerland has been in the better neighborhood. And as for the Central African Republic, perhaps you could take a look on a map. In principle, its lifeline should be the Ubangui River. That used to be the cost-effective way of getting out the logs that were a key export product. But unfortunately, downstream from the Central African Republic was an area nominally part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, civil war territory, and hence lawless. So the river could not be used and the logs were sent by road. Actually sent by the road. These logs were huge. I seem to remember from somewhere that road damage increases by the cube of the axle weight. A consequence of hauling these logs by road was that it destroyed the road. I stood by the road and saw it happening. I decided to look at this statistically. Globally, how did landlocked countries grow, and how was their growth affected by their neighbors? This time, my partner was Steve O'Connell, a professor at Swarthmore College. We found that whether being landlocked mattered at all depended upon what other opportunities were open to the country. If it had a large natural resource surplus, that, rather than whether it was landlocked, became its defining feature. That is why Botswana could do so well despite being landlocked. It got the management of its huge natural resource wealth right. As we saw in the preceding chapter, if a country has a lot of natural resources, it is in all likelihood going to be uncompetitive in other exports, the theory of Dutch disease. Being coastal does not confer on a resource-rich country an export opportunity that the country would lose were it landlocked, for this opportunity has already been closed off by the resource abundance. And a landlocked resource-rich country is not at much of a disadvantage in exporting its resource wealth, since natural resources are usually so valuable that they can be exported despite the higher transport costs associated with being landlocked. Indeed, compared to the resource-scarce landlocked countries, resource-rich landlocked ones at least have the chance of making a success of the opportunity, which is what Botswana did. So in trying to establish what characteristics are serious impediments to growth, it is evidently sensible to supplement the characteristic of being landlocked with the qualifier that this matters only for countries that are not abundant in natural resources. But this still leaves 30% of the bottom billion in the category. We found that in general, all countries, landlocked or not, benefited from the growth of their neighbors. Growth spills over. The global average was that if a country's neighbors grew by an additional 1%, the country grew at an additional 0.4%. So nice neighborhoods, in the sense of fast growth, are pretty helpful for everyone. Globally, resource-scarce, landlocked countries seem to make a special effort to piggyback on the growth of their neighbors. For the landlocked, the spillover is not 0.4%, but 0.7%. So countries such as Switzerland disproportionately orient their economies to serve the markets of their neighbors. If you are coastal, you serve the world. If you are landlocked, you serve your neighbors. That is fine if you are Switzerland, but it is not much use if you are Uganda, with neighbors that might be geographically more fortunate, either they are coastal or they are rich in natural resources, but for one reason or another have failed to harness their growth opportunities. To generalize that statement, resource-scarce, landlocked countries must depend on their neighbors for growth. What else can they do? But the viability of this option depends upon whether those neighbors are stuck in one or another of the growth traps. Consider Uganda's neighbors again. Kenya and Tanzania for many years have been stuck because of poor policy, a trap we'll come to. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, and Somalia are stuck in conflict. Rwanda is stuck in the same landlocked trap as Uganda, and is not so great on conflict either. Uganda can neither access the global market because of the high transport costs of hauling along neglected Kenyan roads, nor rely upon reorienting its economy to its neighbors, as they are stuck too. Being both resource scarce and landlocked, along with having neighbors who either do not have opportunities or do not take them, pretty well condemns a country to the slow lane. But are many nations stuck in this situation? Outside Africa, no. In the developing world, excluding Africa, only 1% of the population lives in countries that are both landlocked and resource scarce. Another way of saying this is that other than in Africa, areas that are far from the coast and don't have resources simply don't become countries. Pretty sensible that. Such areas are so dependent upon what the neighboring areas do that it is better to be part of their polity rather than independent. But Africa is different. Around 30% of Africa's population lives in landlocked, resource-scarce countries. A reasonable case could be made that such places never should have become countries. However, the deed is done. These countries exist and will continue to do so. It gets worse. Recall that globally, landlocked, resource-scarce countries, at least in part, get around their problems by orienting their economies to maximize growth spillovers from their neighbors. Each additional 1% that the neighbors grow raises their growth by 0.7%. Again, Africa is different. Africa's landlocked countries are not oriented toward their neighbors. Both their infrastructure and their policies are oriented either to be completely inward-looking or toward the world market. Neighbors are just in the way of the world market, not themselves the market, and this shows up in the growth spillovers. In Africa, if the neighbors grow an extra 1%, how much does this spill over into the growth of a landlocked country? Well, basically, it does not spill over. The world average for all countries, landlocked or not, is 0.4%. For the non-African landlocked, it is 0.7%, and for the African landlocked, it is 0.2%, virtually nothing. Of course, to date, it has not mattered very much. Usually, in Africa, the neighbors of the landlocked have barely been growing, so there has been precious little growth to spill over. But as things stand, even if the more fortunate countries started to grow, it would not help the landlocked. I tried to do what little I could for the Central African Republic. Neither the World Bank nor the IMF had a single staffer resident in the country. I tried to get some donor interest, but a key donor said that it was not worth it because the government was facing security problems. Maybe they knew something. A few months later, there was a successful coup. The former prime minister sheltered for some months in an embassy and is currently living in Paris. So now the country is in the coup trap also. It is possible to be in more than one trap at once. So what can a landlocked country do? Being landlocked and resource scarce in a bad neighborhood makes development harder, but can a country develop nevertheless if its government does the right things? That was, in essence, what the Prime Minister of the Central African Republic wanted to know. In trying to offer an answer, we are exploring the limits of national action by the landlocked countries of the bottom billion. Landlocked, resource-scarce countries have no single obvious winning growth strategy that will take them to middle-income status, so they need to be ingenious. Strategy 1. Increase neighborhood growth spillovers. What can be done to increase growth spillovers from neighbors? Cross-border trade is primarily a matter of transport infrastructure and trade policy. However, cross-border trade depends upon the transport infrastructure on both sides of the border, so half of the problem is outside the control of the government of the landlocked country. What about trade policy? I will explore this more in Chapter 10. While the landlocked countries have a strong interest in regional integration, including the elimination of intra-regional trade barriers, they also have a strong interest in reducing the external trade barriers of the region. Regional trade barriers generate an invisible transfer from the poor landlocked countries to their more industrialized and richer neighbors. Within a regional trade bloc, the landlocked countries should therefore lobby for the lowest possible trade barriers. But again, that depends on the neighbors. When the East African Community revived its common external tariff in 2003, Uganda was forced to raise its trade barriers against non-members. Strategy 2. Improve neighbors' economic policies. A An implication of spillovers is that once economies are better integrated, the economic performance of neighbors matters more. The faster neighbors grow, the faster the landlocked country will grow. Not only can the landlocked not afford to make policy mistakes, they cannot afford to have their more fortunate neighbors make mistakes. Hence, good policy choices of the more fortunately endowed neighbors are regional public goods, and so tend to be undersupplied through individual national decisions. This is not a reciprocal relationship. It matters to Niger enormously that Nigeria should adopt good policies, but whether Niger adopts good policies is of little consequence for Nigeria. So Niger can plead to Nigeria, but there is not really the basis for a deal. Strategy 3. Improve coastal access. Access to the sea is a vital interest for landlocked countries. But remember, the costs of access depend upon the transport infrastructure and policy decisions of coastal neighbors. Since the neighboring governments are providing a regional public good, usually they have insufficient incentive to provide as much of it as is needed. Strategy 4. Become a haven for the region. Many business services are regionally traded rather than globally traded. For example, some financial services. Often these services depend upon a good policy environment. If one country in a region manages to set policies clearly superior to those of its neighbors, it will attract these services and export them around the region. The classic example of this was Lebanon, which became a financial center for the entire Middle East. As Lebanon demonstrates, a country does not need to be landlocked in order to become a regional haven. The landlocked have no absolute advantage. However, they do have a comparative advantage. Landlocked countries evidently have fewer alternative strategies than more fortunately endowed countries, and so can be seen to have a stronger incentive to sustain necessary reforms. The possibility of becoming the center for regional goods that are highly policy sensitive, such as finance, gives landlocked countries a differential incentive to adopt good policies. Strategy 5. Don't be airlocked or e-locked. The technology of trade has to some extent shifted in favor of landlocked countries. Air transport is much more important than it used to be. There are significant economies of scale in air transport, and in this respect, the landlocked countries are at a disadvantage because they are small markets for air services. However, low costs are possible even at modest scale. The key is deregulation. Nigeria provides a good model of how an open skies policy can radically reduce the cost of air services and increase their frequency. Possibly these very companies might provide the foundation for a region-wide, low-cost air service for landlocked Africa. More generally, the landlocked need cost-cutting companies like Ryanair, EasyJet, and Southwest Airlines. What they have had is staggeringly expensive and badly run state airlines, the most celebrated being that of Zaire, whose planes were periodically commandeered for the First Lady's shopping trips. E-services now have the potential to deliver rapid economic growth. This is the story of recent economic development in India. Because India is a coastal economy, it has many options for global integration. The landlocked do not have such a range of options. E-services are attractive because distance is irrelevant. The twin pillars of being competitive in e-services are having good telecommunications infrastructure and having workers with post-primary education. Good telecommunications depends upon getting regulatory and competition policies right. It is a relatively simple matter to tell when they are wrong. Prices are too high relative to global benchmarks and coverage is inadequate. Strategy 6. Encourage remittances. Because landlocked economies have fewer options for growth, they are likely to experience substantial emigration. This, of course, depends upon the willingness of other governments to let in immigrants from the bottom billion, and in any case, it leaches out the society's talent. However, emigration can be turned to some advantage through enabling migrants to make large remittances. Maximizing remittances depends upon several steps. One is to educate people so that they are employable in higher income economies rather than simply as unskilled workers in neighboring countries that are almost as poor. Another is to facilitate the finding of jobs in such economies. A model for such practices is the Philippines, where training is targeted to the needs of high income economies and the government provides information and embassy services to make hiring of its citizens easy. Another is to encourage emigrant workers to remit part of their incomes. This depends upon banking systems and exchange rates. An overvalued exchange rate taxes remittances and therefore discourages them. A longer-term strategy is to encourage the diaspora to invest in the country, for example, building homes for family in retirement and linking the second-generation emigrants more closely to the country. Strategy 7. Create a transparent and investor-friendly environment for resource prospecting. The area of landlocked low-income countries currently classified as resource scarce is enormous. It seems likely that there are valuable resources in the ground that have not yet been discovered. The main impediment to prospecting is likely to be the risks perceived by resource extraction companies. Some of these are political, but the more important one is probably the risk to the reputation of the company should the host country's governance of the resource revenues become manifestly problematic. Not all companies are concerned about the risk to their reputation, because not all companies have good reputations to protect. However, this gives rise to what is known technically as an adverse selection problem. The companies attracted to the risky environments are those that are not concerned about poor governance, and so have no interest in helping to avoid the problems of the resource trap. This adverse selection is now extending to the governments behind many resource extraction companies. In 2006, the Vice President of China toured Africa with the revealing refrain, "We won't ask questions." Strategy 8. Rural Development. Because landlocked countries do not have the option of rapid industrialization, the bulk of their populations will continue to be rural for a long time. In turn, this implies that policies for rural development should receive higher priority than in other economies. Whereas the policies needed for industrial exports are pretty standard around the world, policies for rural development must be adapted to local circumstances, and so require a much larger investment in local knowledge. A further constraint upon rural development is the subsidies that are paid to farmers in Europe, Japan, and the United States. Strategy 9. Try to attract aid. Even with the government's best efforts at these strategies, the country is likely to stay poor for a long time, so it should try to be as attractive as possible to donors. I take this up in Chapter 9. Why it matters for G8 policy. As you will have noticed, most of these strategies are not under the full control of a country's government. It is dependent upon its neighbors, or upon international actors such as donors. Still, a good government can most surely make a difference in a landlocked, resource-scarce country, even with bad neighbors. For example, governments in Uganda and Burkina Faso have sustained decent growth rates for over a decade, though some of this was recovery from the damage of terrible predecessors. But I can find no example of a landlocked, resource-scarce country with bad neighbors that has made it to middle-income status. They will be stuck in poverty unless we help them far more than we have to date. How to help them is one of the questions I address in Part 4. Chapter 5. Bad Governance in a Small Country. Governance and economic policies help to shape economic performance, but there is an asymmetry in the consequences of getting them right and getting them wrong. Excellent governance and economic policies can help the growth process, but there is a ceiling to feasible growth rates at around 10%. Economies just cannot grow much faster than this, no matter what governments do. By contrast, terrible governance and policies can destroy an economy with alarming speed. For example, President Robert Mugabe must take responsibility for the economic collapse in Zimbabwe since 1998, culminating in inflation of over 1,000% a year. That decline is visible from the moment you set foot in the country and walk through its deserted international airport. Because of this asymmetry, the implementation of restraints is likely to be even more important than the promotion of government effectiveness. I think that the advocates of good governance and the advocates of good policies, rather different groups of people, have both somewhat oversold their wares. Good governance and policy help a country to realize its opportunities, but they cannot generate opportunities when none exist. They cannot defy gravity. Even the best governance and policies are not going to turn Malawi into a rich country. It just does not have the opportunities. Until recently, Nigeria's best phase of economic policy, which was less than wonderful, was the reform phase of the late 1980s. But the benefits of these reforms were completely swamped by the coincident crash of the world price of oil. Although really bad governance and policies can ruin the most promising prospects, even here qualifiers are necessary. An obvious one is that in the short term, if the external shocks such as export prices are sufficiently favorable, a society can get away with them. To an extent, Nigeria did this during the first oil boom of 1974 to 86, and President Hugo Chavez is repeating this experience in Venezuela today. A less obvious but more important qualifier is that governance and policies are multidimensional, and not all dimensions matter in all circumstances. In the 2005 Transparency International Ratings of Corruption, two societies tied for global bottom place, Bangladesh and Chad. There is no doubting that both of these countries suffer from bad governance. The amazing thing is that being the most corrupt country on earth has not prevented Bangladesh from adopting fairly reasonable economic policies and from growing. One interpretation might be that it is economic policies such as exchange rates and tariffs that matter, rather than whether public officials are honest and competent. But I do not believe this is the right interpretation. Rather, I think that what matters is determined by differences in opportunities. Although Bangladesh would surely have done much better had it been less corrupt, it is a classic case of a resource-scarce, coastal, low-income country. At least since the 1980s, the development path for such countries has been pretty clear. Export labor-intensive manufactures and services. Such a development strategy need not be very demanding of government. Even the minimal state model of government that was briefly promoted by the World Bank in the 1980s, in which the functions of government are drastically curtailed, is probably sufficient for success. The government merely has to avoid doing harm rather than actively do much good. Exporters simply need an environment of moderate taxation, macroeconomic stability, and a few transport facilities. Somehow, partly by means of export processing zones, which provide islands of better governance, the government of Bangladesh has managed to keep its bad governance from choking off export activity. Chad, by contrast, is a landlocked country with aid and oil. It has no scope for exporting, and to make use of aid and oil, the government must be able to spend money effectively. For this strategy to work, the government must be more ambitious than a do-no-harm approach. It must actually be capable of doing some good. The minimal state is not a viable model in the context of oil and aid. The government must transform its money into public services. Does corruption impede development given these opportunities? Of course it does. In 2004, a survey tracked money released by the Ministry of Finance in Chad intended for rural health clinics. The survey had the extremely modest purpose of finding out how much of the money actually reached the clinics, not whether the clinics spent it well, or whether the staff of the clinics knew what they were doing, just where the money went. Amazingly, less than 1% of it reached the clinics. 99% failed to reach its destination. Bad governance matters in Chad more than in Bangladesh, because Chad's only option is for government to provide services, and corruption has closed off this option. So governance and policies matter, conditional upon opportunities. But how do we tell whether governance and policies are adequate? Assessment of these is subjective and can be controversial. Does France have worse governance than the United States? Are Sweden's economic policies better than those of Britain? Fortunately, controversy greatly diminishes by the time we reach the countries of the bottom billion. Nobody seriously doubts that Angola has worse governance than India, or that Chad has worse economic policies than China. Bad policies and governance need not be a trap. Societies can learn from failure, and many do. The most dramatic error correction of modern times has occurred in China. In the 1960s, Mao Zedong hurled China into ruin, to an adoring chorus from the Western media. But in response to failure, the Chinese political elite swung policy 180 degrees and generated the biggest economic success in history. Mao made his own invaluable contribution by dropping dead. In part spurred by China, India followed. Why have China and India, and indeed many other countries, changed policies while others have not? Why is bad governance so persistent in some environments? One evident reason is that not everybody loses from it. The leaders of many of the poorest countries in the world are themselves among the global super-rich. They like things the way they are, and so it pays to keep their citizens uneducated and ill-informed. Unfortunately, many of the politicians and senior public officials in the countries of the bottom billion are villains. But persistence is not just due to self-interest. Among the politicians and officials, many are people of integrity, and sometimes, against the odds, they gain the upper hand. These are the moments of reform. But economic reform is not just a matter of political will. It is also a technical matter, and in the bottom billion there is a chronic shortage of people with the requisite knowledge. Few citizens get the training needed, and those who do get it leave. All too often, brave reformers get overwhelmed by the forces pitted against them before they can see a strategy through to completion. And finally, there is not much popular enthusiasm for economic reform because it has got a bad name. In the 1980s, the international financial institutions tried to coerce governments into reform through conditionality. A government could get extra aid only if it agreed to change some of its economic policies. Nobody likes being coerced, least of all newly powerful local elites that are hypersensitive about sovereignty and see their gravy trains threatened. Conditionality turned out to be a paper tiger. Governments discovered they only needed to promise to reform, not actually do it. Meanwhile, the Western left, locked in its domestic struggle with US President Ronald Reagan and British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, conflated the limited reforms being urged on the governments of the bottom billion with the neoliberal savaging of the state they were fighting at home. As a result, reforms that should have been popular with all except corrupt elites became toxic in the media, both within and outside Africa. The essential struggle between villains and heroes within the bottom billion became twisted into one between Africa and the IMF. What determines the pace of reform starting from a situation in which governance and policy is undeniably bad? In effect, what determines whether the villains or the heroes win the power struggle? To conduct a statistical analysis, Lisa Chauvet, a young French researcher, and I needed to reduce amorphous entities such as governance and policies to numerical scores. We used an index called the Country Policy and Institutional Assessment, produced by the World Bank. At the time we did the work, the index was not publicly available. However, the World Bank wanted to know what might promote turnarounds, and so released the data to us for the purposes of the study. The bank's board subsequently decided to make it publicly available as of 2006. The index has several important advantages. It provides data for a long period and is intended to be comparable across countries. It also has the disadvantage of being subjective, but since objective quantitative measures are available only as occasional snapshots, there is no realistic alternative. Possibly its main drawback for our purposes is that it can be gamed by the staff who are making the judgment. A higher rating attracts a larger lending program, and this can be advantageous to the staff concerned. Both in principle and in practice, such manipulation is policed, but it is unlikely to have been eliminated. The scoring system rates 20 aspects of governance and policy on a 6-point scale. We imposed a low cutoff to define the really bad. I doubt if there is much professional disagreement that the countries that fall below this cutoff indeed have really poor governance and policies. There will undoubtedly be disagreement in the sense that some countries that do not fall below the cutoff nevertheless have severe problems. For example, despite being highly corrupt, on this measure, Bangladesh overall has economic policies that are comfortably above the cutoff. It was not always that way. Bangladesh is one of the countries that very slowly inched its way from a truly dreadful configuration of policies and governance to one that, though still poor, is manifestly not debilitating for growth. For want of a better term, I will call those low-income countries that are below the cutoff for governance and economic policies failing states. This is the sort of popular and emotive term that I do not usually like to use, but in this case I think it has some rationale. such states are failing in two senses. Most directly, they are failing their citizens. Populations in most of the low-income world live in countries that are growing rapidly, whereas these countries are stagnating. Yet more troubling is that low-income countries that fail to grow are living dangerously, as we saw in Chapter 2. Getting the definition right is nevertheless tricky. Not all low-income states that fall below our cutoff have been failing states. For a number of countries, the rating crashed and then rapidly rebounded as policies changed relatively rapidly. Such temporary crashes are not of interest to us. It is surely much easier to restore a country to reasonable policies if it has only just abandoned them than if it has been stuck with bad policies for a long time. Indeed, the temporary crashes that we observe in the data may sometimes be spurious assessments that are subsequently reversed. We therefore only count the country as a failing state if the rating has stayed low for a continuous period of 4 years. These criteria give us lists of states that can be classified as failing year by year. To show you what they mean in practice, recent failing states include Angola, the Central African Republic, Haiti, Liberia, Sudan, the Solomon Islands, Somalia, and Zimbabwe. It would surely be difficult to argue with any of these assessments. The Democratic Republic of the Congo hovers around the borderline. If this is the borderline, you know that the cutoff is low. More than three-quarters of the population of the bottom billion live in countries that have at some time been failing states by this definition. Do failing states turn around of their own accord? Launching a turnaround takes courage. I cannot measure that, and so it is not going to be included in my analysis. But behind the moments of change, there are always a few people within these societies who have decided to try to make a difference. Successful turnarounds are not common, but this does not usually imply a want of courage. I remember meeting the brave man who had told President Hastings Banda, the dictator of Malawi, that his policies were failing. This man, who also was called Banda, though he was not related to the president, had explained to the president that Press Holdings, the state within a state that Banda ran as his personal property, was heading for ruin. This evidence was a necessary first step in persuading the president to change policies. Given Banda's record, it was risky. The president was far from being a fool, but he hated opposition. The country was headed straight for crisis unless he was faced with the facts. But facing him with the facts might backfire. It was a situation that required courage, and courage was forthcoming. President Banda did not shoot Banda the messenger. He jailed him. Courage earned this man 12 years in a prison cell. Turnarounds are rare because reformers are often suppressed and sometimes pay a high price for their efforts. In the long march through the statistical evidence that follows, try not to lose sight of what attempts at reform actually involve. If we were to study turnarounds statistically, we had to define them. Of course, the simplest criterion would be the converse of the conditions for state failure, but this would rapidly lead to absurdities. If the rating rises from a long stay just below the cutoff to just above it, we do not want to regard this as a turnaround. Given the subjective nature of the rating, such small improvements might be entirely spurious, and even if they are genuine, they hardly constitute a significant event. We therefore confined ourselves to turnarounds that were so large as to be unmistakable. We allowed a turnaround to be achieved over any time period. Bangladesh is an example of a very gradual turnaround. There is no dramatic event worthy of particular notice, but over a quarter century, policies and some institutions improved from abysmal to adequate, though governance did not, as you will recall. However, a large improvement is not enough. It must be sustained. We decided to define sustained as being at least 5 years. Had we chosen a very long period of sustained improvement, we would have excluded situations such as in Indonesia. The improvement in Indonesia began in 1967 and was broadly sustained until the collapse associated with the Asian financial crisis of 1998. It seemed to us unreasonable to attribute that collapse to failures in the original reforms. Having established what we meant by a turnaround in a failing state, we were at last ready to investigate what generated them. We first investigated the preconditions for a turnaround, and then tried to find out what determined whether a turnaround, once it had started, progressed to a decisive escape from being a failing state. The preconditions for turnarounds. To establish the preconditions for a turnaround is technically a little like establishing the preconditions for a civil war. We estimated the probability of a turnaround, year by year, among all the potential turnaround countries, and searched among a wide range of potential characteristics for those that mattered. Somewhat to our surprise, we could find only three characteristics that were reliably significant in determining whether a turnaround occurred. Starting from being a failing state, a country was more likely to achieve a sustained turnaround the larger its population, the greater the proportion of its population that had secondary education, and, perhaps more surprisingly, if it had recently emerged from civil war. Among the many characteristics that did not seem to matter one way or the other were democracy and political rights. Let's go through that list again, more slowly. Democracy doesn't seem to help policy turnaround. That is extremely disappointing, both for advocates of democracy and because democracy is more common now in the countries of the bottom billion than it used to be. Having a large population and having a high proportion of people with secondary education both help. They may well be pointing to the same thing. Countries need a critical mass of educated people in order to work out and implement a reform strategy. The impetus for change must come from within the society, the heroes. Their chances of success depend on the capacities of those around them. For example, China under Mao Zedong and Tanzania under Julius Nyerere both failed, and indeed failed through somewhat similar strategies. The Chinese elite was able to rethink and adopt a radically different strategy. There were also Tanzanians of ability and courage who pressed for change and who eventually triumphed. But in the 1980s, there were not enough of them, and it did not help that they were opposed by Western Marxists who flattered the government into complacency. I remember one of the reformers saying, "If they think it's so wonderful, why don't they come and live here?" Finally, there is the odd-looking result that reform is more likely after civil war. Actually, it is not so odd. Typically, although post-conflict countries start off with dreadful governance and policies, that first decade sees substantial improvement. The politics are unusually fluid because the old interests have been shaken up, so it is relatively easy to get change. I'm going to return to that in part 4 when we look at interventions. And now for the bad news. Overall, we find that the probability of a sustained turnaround starting in any year is very low, a mere 1.6%. Countries are therefore likely to stay as failing states for a long time. Indeed, from this annual probability, we can calculate something called the mathematical expectation, which is the average length of time it takes to get out of being a failing state. It comes out as 59 years. Incipient turnarounds. We also looked at the early stages of a reform to see what determined whether momentum was sustained. Improvements might continue right through to a decisive escape from the trap, or they might collapse, with the country reverting to its initial state. Or the country might just stall, staying in limbo for year after year. We first faced the issue of how to define an incipient turnaround. We ended up investigating two different situations, one in which a turnaround had already gotten started, but not gone very far, and another in which a new president had just come into office. Although the question of what sustains incipient turnaround sounds virtually the same as what gets them going, technically the two require a completely different approach. This question is about what is happening as time rolls by, whereas the preconditions can be reduced to a simple world of before and after. So what did we find? Here, I will differentiate between external interventions that work, which I will discuss in part 4, and characteristics that need to exist for these interventions to work. There were six of these characteristics that actually seemed to matter. An incipient reform was more likely to progress to a sustained turnaround if the country had higher income, a larger population, and a greater proportion of the population with education. It was less likely to progress if the leader had been in office a long time, if the country experienced a favorable shift in the terms of trade, and if it had recently emerged from civil war. Compared with the preconditions for a turnaround, there are some striking similarities and one striking difference. The similarities. Countries with large and educated populations are doubly blessed, for turnarounds are both more likely to get launched and more likely to succeed once launched. The sharp difference is the post-conflict experience. Post-conflict countries are more likely to achieve a sustained turnaround, but any particular incipient reform is less likely to progress. How can these two seemingly contradictory results be reconciled? I think that what they are telling us is that post-conflict situations are highly fluid. Some sort of reform is much more likely to be initiated in post-conflict states than in other failing states, but many of these incipient reforms will fail because it is harder to sustain any continuous course of change. This suggests that there is an important difference between post-conflict situations and other failing states. Recall the depressing statistic that the expected time before a failing state achieves decisive change is 59 years. The normal condition for a failing state is to be stuck, as bad policies and governance are highly persistent. Post-conflict situations are the major exception. They are failing states, but change is relatively easy. This suggests that our policy interventions to help failing states need to differentiate between types of situations, treating post-conflict situations as major opportunities. I will have more to say on that in Part 4. The costs of neglect, why it matters for G8 policy. The typical failing state is going to go on failing for a long time. Does it matter? The whole topic of failing states is fashionable because people have an uneasy sense that it probably does matter. After 9/11, the U.S. aid budget was increased by 50%, and the main impetus for it was the perceived need to fix failing states. In Part 4, you will see how, ironically, this is what aid is not going to do. But can we get beyond that inchoate sense that failing states are a problem? Can we actually quantify the costs of a failing state? Remember, I have defined a failing state in terms of its bad policies and governance. The core of the cost is what results from these policy and governance failings for the economy of the country itself and for its neighbors. Lisa Chauvet and I decided to estimate a lower bound to these costs, leaving out a lot of the consequences of state failure that are legitimate objects of concern. For example, we omitted the security costs implied by an increased risk of civil war, and the human costs implied by avoidably high infant mortality. To give some sense of how much we left out, remember that in Chapter 2, I put a figure of around $64 billion for the typical cost to a region of a civil war. To avoid double counting of the cost of the traps, here I'm going to stick to the cost of a failing state that remains at peace. To estimate the economic cost of being a failing state required yet another battery of techniques. This took time, and the pressure was building, since our work was being financed by a consortium of donors. Like many people in the policy world, they commissioned the work at the point where they realized they needed answers, and so they wanted the answers quickly. The policy world is deeply suspicious of the world of research, often for good reason. With this sort of work, there is no progress in the sense of usable results until pretty late in the day. And it is risky, because sometimes the data turn out not to be adequate to answer the question, and so the whole effort is wasted. In this case, fortunately, we got results that were surprisingly robust. The costs of a failing state build up year by year. The growth rate of the failing state is very sharply reduced. Indeed, it is likely to be an absolute decline, and the growth of neighbors is also sharply reduced. Since failing states take such a long time to turn around, these costs continue way into the future. Economists routinely convert flows of future costs into a single number, which they term a discounted present value. We estimated that the cost of a single failing state over its entire history of failure to itself and its neighbors is around $100 billion. This is our lower bound estimate of what a sustained turnaround is worth. It is a mesmerizingly large number, but then the phenomenon we are considering is indeed dramatic. A world without failing states would be a transformed world. Is the figure ridiculous? I think that there is a good case for saying that it is too low, for it considers only the costs to the country itself and its neighbors. To infer how rich countries value turnarounds, look at Iraq. The U.S.-led military intervention in Iraq provides us with a rare opportunity to calculate what a key international actor regarded as the benefits to itself of one sustained turnaround. The purpose of the intervention was clearly stated as being regime change. The regime in Iraq was a classic example of a failing but politically secure state, so the costs of state failure could reasonably be seen as likely to be highly persistent.